Welcome to The Debrief, everyone. Several coaches charged in the so-called Varsity Blues college admission scandal are asking a court to throw out some of the charges against them. The cases have ensnared actress Lori Loughlin and her husband, as well as actress Felicity Huffman. The several coaches say they cannot be charged with bribery because their college had a policy not to accept money in connection with any admissions decision. The argument is that the coaches couldn't have bribed the college because the policy forbade the college from accepting the bribe. In other words, the extra money would have been pointless. Meanwhile, an athletics administrator with one of the colleges is arguing that the defendants didn't associate closely enough to even form a conspiracy. So, three attorneys are here with us tonight to discuss this case. Let's begin with Imran Ansari. So, Imran, this to me seems like a big deflection. Big deal, the colleges had policies not to accept the money. The college isn't the one accused of taking the money. It's the defendants, or in this particular case, the defendants' business. So, does this even work?
Well, I think they're trying to argue it would be a legal impossibility for this crime to be completed. And because of that, it somehow mitigates the charges that they've been charged with. A legal impossibility, you can't commit a crime that you can't complete. That's the argument here.
Okay, but again, I mean, so if the college doesn't take the money, you could still have bribery if one of the defendants is accused of giving money to the other defendant or the defendant's business, right?
Well, it would be an attempt. So I think they're trying to mitigate the charges here. They're trying to find a legal aspect on how they could get these charges thrown out. So a good defense attorney is going to explore all those options, and that's what they're doing here.
It certainly is an option here. I'm not arguing that. Is it going to be a successful one? That's what we'll have to wait and see. So Gigi Gonzalez here with us as well. So Gigi, how tricky is this going to become for the defendants who remain? Because a good number of the other defendants, coaches, college people, whatnot, pleaded guilty and signed cooperation agreements. So if you have some defendants saying this couldn't have worked, and then others presumably lining up to testify that yes, indeed it did work, is this ultimately going to turn into one of the biggest groups of people thrown under the biggest bus in the history of American litigation or not?
That's what it's looking like. That's what it's shaping up to be. You know, when you have so many defendants and, you know, a whole bunch of them accepting deals to cooperate with the government and their testimonies, they have to offer substantial assistance to the government in order to get a really sweet deal out of this. So anything these flip defendants are going to say are going to be very detrimental to the remaining defendants here. And it's going to be quite a detangling session the attorneys will have to grapple with.
Those cooperation agreements are written on paper for some of the defendants, so the testimony, as you say, will be really interesting here if it goes all the way to trial. Michael Bryant, didn't forget about you here. Loughlin's defense is basically that she thought the money was a legitimate donation to USC. Now we have at least one coach saying UCLA, different college, wouldn't have even taken this type of donation because they don't do that. But then we have to be careful. Again, we've got different colleges here because there are some colleges which apparently were keeping spreadsheets of donations and application numbers all lined up together, and that's in the court record here. So I guess is the ultimate lesson here. We really need to be careful about all the different defendants and all the different colleges?
Well, you can't lump everything together, that's for sure. And I like Imran's use of impossibility because most of us don't see that after law school. You know, it's just a crazy defense that isn't very successful. In this case, I think it is an attempt to just minimize the charges. At best, nobody's getting out from under them, and for the reasons you suggest.
Or at least to insulate or isolate the college itself from the accusations. That may be going on here as well. Let's move on to our next report here. Police have filed charges against a woman suspected in the case of an Austin, Texas mother found dead and a newborn baby found alive. Heidi Broussard and her infant, Margot Carey, vanished around 7:30 in the morning back on December 12th after Broussard dropped off her older child at school. Heidi's longtime friend, Megan Firamusca, faces two counts of kidnapping and one count of tampering with evidence, a human corpse. Authorities are trying to figure out who strangled Broussard to death and left her in the trunk of Firamusca's car. Firamusca has not been charged with murder. The mother of Fort Worth, Texas shooting victim Tatiana Jefferson says she's thankful for the murder indictment against the former police officer who pulled the trigger. That grand jury indictment came down late last week against Aaron Dean, and it followed a prosecutor's decision 2 months ago to charge Dean with murder. Jefferson's mother said Tatiana did nothing wrong. that she knows the case has a long way to go and that she believes Dean will be accountable for murder. Jefferson's neighbor called 911 because her door was open late at night. This body camera video showed police looking in the front door but not announcing their presence. They continued around the property, shining tactical lights into windows. When Officer Aaron Dean approached one window, he saw Jefferson and fired almost immediately. We stopped the frame before the bullet was fired. Police documents say officers later interviewed Jefferson's nephew, who said Tatiana saw the lights in her yard and went for her gun. The Fort Worth Police Department recently released video of suspect Aaron Dean's job interview back in 2017 after local reporters filed a public records request to see it. Dean explained back then why he wanted to be an officer, and some of his words now sound chilling.
When I was a kid, I wanted to go military, thought about it, just never did it. Should have in retrospect, and so this is kind of a way to do some of those same things without having to deploy overseas. Also, just finding unfulfillment in the desk job and the day-to-day grind and wanting something that's more active, something where I actually get to go out and to interact with people and help them in a very immediate way, whatever the situation might be. Time to fight is certainly if I'm under or someone that I care about or I'm responsible for is under imminent threat. I do have a license to carry and carry every day, and that, of course, is constantly on my mind as I walk around carrying a weapon for self-defense or defense of others.
Will you be able to kill somebody if you have to?
No problem.
Let's move on again here. The governor of Wisconsin has decided there will be no pardon or commutation for Brendan Dassey, whose conviction was made famous by the Netflix film Making a Murderer. Dassey and his uncle, Stephen Avery, were convicted by separate juries of killing freelance photographer Teresa Halbach in 2005. Governor Tony Evers said Dassey wasn't eligible for a pardon because Dassey had not served his entire sentence. The governor is also refusing to commute sentences as a matter of policy. Dassey's attorneys say the people who reviewed Dassey's petition failed to review its merits and that the governor has the power to deliver justice where the courts fail to do so. So let's turn back to our panel here. Michael Bryant, I'll start with you. Is this ultimately fair for the governor to turn around and say, well, I'm not going to really look into things too much. I'm just going to say no.
You know, it's not. And let's face it, this case, and nobody knows it better than you, Aaron, has been filled with unfairness throughout the process, from interrogations to sentencing to relooking at various parts of the investigation. I think I'm surprised that it's continuing to raise eyebrows the way this entire thing is being handled.
So is the issue here, in your opinion, Michael Bryant, with the way the interrogation went down, the way the trial went down, the different state theories, is it everything? Is it just so much that you think the governor should have stepped in here?
It would have been helpful, but I don't think he had the guts. I mean, the fact is, this is the public opinion in this case is over the top. It is high profile. It is sensitive. Would have been pretty gutsy for the governor to do something.
Well, yeah, and Imran Ansari sitting here with me in New York as well. You've got local voters who largely probably want to see this guy remain incarcerated. They don't like all the international, the nationwide attention being focused on this. And you've got a governor who's not running for governor in Texas or Ireland or anywhere else where people have been following this case. He's running in Wisconsin. So does the governor, just to use Michael's words, not have the guts to overturn a local jury verdict?
Well, I think he's going the safe route. Now, this is the sort of power of the media we have today, the power of these documentaries and docuseries, which really bring a light, on an international scale, on a national scale, as to some, injustices that have taken place in our justice system. But he's pandering possibly to the local populace, to his voters, but he's doing the safe thing. It would be going maybe out of the comfort zone for him to really look at this and go that extra distance. So I think he's going the safe thing as a politician.
And certainly he can do that. But Gigi, what do you make of this? Should he have pulled the trigger here and said, we're going to let this guy out of prison, or should the governor just wash his hands of it and walk away?
I think that the governor owed at least some attention to this case. Like all of the panelists have said, this is a case that has garnered international attention, has had two seasons on Netflix devoted to, describing this case, and people are invested in this. So I think the governor needed to take some time to consider the merits of, 250 national experts, pleading him to please consider commutation.
And we will wait and see if the governor changes his mind. It seems relatively unlikely at this point. The brother of millionaire pedophile Jeffrey Epstein fears for his safety, according to an interview on a radio show. That report came from former New York medical examiner Dr. Michael Bodden. The brother of Jeffrey Epstein said that if Epstein was killed behind bars, then he, the brother, may also be a target. Bodden, of course, is the husband of Law and Crime Network host and attorney Linda Kenny Bodden. The attorney for one of the officers accused of screwing up on the job by failing to properly monitor Epstein's cell block spoke to the Law and Crime Network to address the conspiracy theories that Epstein did not commit suicide.
No doubt it was a suicide. I mean, it's just as I've had people ask me about it, and my view is I no sooner want to debate how Epstein killed himself with those conspiracy theorists than I do want to argue the shape of the globe with flat earthers. He killed himself. Period. Full stop. Move on to something else. If you look at the indictment of the two guards and you look at the body of evidence that exists and understand what went on here, he killed himself. The idea that somehow he was murdered is insane. Look, one of the false things that gets portrayed about Nick is they put this picture up of this individual who, when he was out of jail 3.5 years ago, was lifting weights and working out, and he was big and healthy. He has been no light in an 8x8 cell or 8x4 cell for 3 years. He is smaller than me now. So the idea that they put up this picture, this hulking man, obviously could have strangled Epstein with one hand, it's ridiculous. Nick is not the same person, mentally or physically, since when he went in there.
Accused sexual predator Harvey Weinstein, meanwhile, will be spending the holidays preparing for his upcoming criminal trial and dealing with a new civil lawsuit. Polish-born model Kaya Sokola says Weinstein sexually abused her shortly after she arrived in New York at age 16. Sokola was a plaintiff in a so-called master settlement, but she decided not to agree to the terms. Her claims are now filed under New York's Child Victims' Rights Act, which reopened the statute of limitations for some sex abuse cases. She explained her reasoning as follows. I cannot accept the proposed global settlement as fair or just. There is no accountability for the perpetrators, insufficient compensation for all of the victims, and millions of dollars going to people that I believe enabled Weinstein. Several of Weinstein's accusers have spoken to the Law and Crime Network for a special one-hour look at the upcoming criminal trial against the former filmmaker. That trial is set to begin in January. Here, Paula Williams tells us what it would mean to her if Harvey Weinstein is indeed found guilty.
It means a lot, and I think it means a lot not just to me, but of my fellow silence breakers and survivors. But more than that, I think it means a lot to just women in general that can relate to this. And it's not just in Hollywood. Obviously, Harvey represents, that part of it. But this happens in all industries with women. And so I think it's gonna be empowering and kind of freeing, hopefully, for a lot of women.
And still ahead here on The Debrief, an officer shot in the face speaks out about that attack. Trooper James Casey talking to Law and Crime about the trial of the man he says he is 100% sure is his shooter. The jury, however, failed to convict on the top charge. We break down the case after the break. The Arizona State Trooper, made famous by the A&E show Live PD, is speaking about the recent partial conviction of the man who he says shot him in the face. A jury convicted Ramon Bueno of lesser charges in the shooting of Trooper James Casey. The jury agreed that Bueno committed aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, possession of a weapon by a prohibited person, and intimidation. But the same jury did not convict Bueno of attempted murder. Trooper Casey said today on the Law and Crime Network that he was surprised that one juror held out on a guilty verdict on the top charge.
I mean, they asked a lot of questions. They seemed to really pay attention. And, so I didn't really see any discourse from any of the jurors. And, it's kind of hard. It's a little surprising, no pun intended, but there is no smoking gun. And I think that's what that juror got hung up on.
Next, Trooper Casey went through the attack and reiterated why he testified he was 100% sure Ramon Bueno was the person who shot him.
I'll go through the car. Lori Richardson had her hands on the steering wheel. Vanessa Martinez had both her hands on her thighs, you know, on her legs. Ramon Bueno had his left hand on his left thigh. He had his right hand under a right blanket. Valeria Jaime was wrapped up in a blanket, and she had it like this, you know, if I'm, you know, so I could see her hands. And Danny Vargas, as I showed the jury, he was laying on his hands and his arms. When I never saw, I mean, he never pulled, Ramon never pulled the gun. Because as I said to the in a testimony, I had been asked that question in an internal investigation, you know, did you see the gun? And I said, no, he's fired it from under that blanket. And I guess where I know one of the questions was, how was I sure Valeria didn't shoot or how was I sure Danny didn't shoot? Well, the two reasons I would say that, well, one is because, you know, I can account for their hands. And two, I believe it was Mike Bedow, the detective or the firearms expert. He said that gun was a 6-inch 357 barrel, 357 caliber with a 6-inch barrel. I would have seen that, you know, Valeria hiding it, she would have never been able to hide it under that blanket. And Danny, I mean, that gun would have been as plain as day if he was holding it. So, you know.
Finally, Trooper Casey said he hopes the judge delivers a sentence that will guarantee Ramon Bueno is never released from prison.
I'm going to request. I would never expect anything, but I would, you know what, if the, I think if the maximum, because of Ramon's in that area of the aggravated assault, because he got the gang enhancing, so it adds 5 years to each sentence. So he would be in the 20.75 to 40 year range per charge. So honestly, if Judge Fisk, if she maxed and stacked him and gave him, you know, 40 consecutive, you know, 340 consecutives, 120 total, I would be more than happy. As I said, you know, Ramon's a very dangerous man. He needs to die in prison.
The defense told the jury at the beginning of this case that Trooper Casey originally identified the wrong man as the shooter. Then during closing arguments, the defense pointed to co-defendant Danny Vargas, who was sitting next to Ramon Bueno in the back seat. The defense said Vargas was the actual shooter.
Danny Vargas not only gave him a false name and acted as though he were sleeping, he told him, I hate cops. Trooper Casey said he kind of countered that by saying, I hate cops too, but that wasn't a funny exchange. Trooper Casey was probably trying to be disarming and just settle things down, but Danny Vargas wasn't. I hate cops. He's the one in the backseat passenger side who had his arms stretched out. I think that's how, relying on your collective memories, how Trooper Casey described it from the witness stand, and that's not suspicious. It should be. That's more suspicious than losing sight of someone's hand. And a juror question, one of 60 or 70 from all of you popped up. It was something like this. If you were not looking up, how do you know Ramon's the shooter? It's his instinct. It's his gut. It's what he thinks. It's what he hopes. It's what he believes. It's not what he saw. It can't be quantified. It can't be measured. It can't be examined. You find that the evidence has fallen short and is not proven guilty. What do? That's easy. Not guilty verdicts across the board. Remember the foreboding words of Danny Vargas and his behavior in the car. I hate cops.
As you just heard there, the defense accused the state and Trooper Casey of pointing to Ramon Bueno as the shooter by process of elimination. The state also used the defendant's alleged gang affiliations to try to get a conviction.
The defense wants to pick apart each piece of the puzzle and say, look over here, it doesn't make sense. But when you put them all together, you have a very clear picture of what the defendant did. All of the evidence points squarely at the defendant. Now the defense wants to point the finger at Danny Vargas because he said, quote, I hate cops. Well, let me share with you something they say back in North Dakota. Birds of a feather flock together, there are no swans in the sewer. It is not a surprise that another Mexican mafia member has a similar outlook on life as the defendant. If Danny was the shooter, why was the defendant so concerned about Valeria snitching in his words? The defense can't decide if they like Lori Richardson or not. She's now testifying 5 years later, and you know memories fade. That is why law enforcement officers, they record their interviews, they write things down in reports, and you know that every single interview was recorded. They want her to be a liar and they want her to be telling the truth. But one thing she has said consistently, maybe not getting the names right, is it was the man seated behind her. And now we know that it was the defendant Ramon Bueno.
Let's wrap things up tonight by bringing everybody back into the discussion. Gigi Gonzalez here. We're sitting here relitigating this, basically. Sort of a bizarre verdict, because the issue was whether the defendant, Ramon Bueno, had the gun, and the jury basically decided that he had the gun, that he just didn't commit attempted murder. Did that strike you as strange?
Very strange, absolutely. You know, and but I think this goes to the defense's strategy and how well they executed it. Their entire theory from the get-go was, we don't know who pulled the trigger, all right? You're going to have conflicting identifications. You're not going to have anyone that say, I saw Ramon pull the trigger, not even the victim in this case. You know, so although it is a very interesting verdict, it's very unusual, it goes to the strength of the defense attorneys here.
Imran Ansari, you were here listening to that interview. Anything jump out at you as a defense attorney?
Well, you know, again, when we looked at this case, when we looked at the arguments set forth by the defense counsel, I think the common theme was that there was a lot of reasonable doubt here. There was inconsistencies in that initial ID. I know that officer picked out a different individual initially. And during the course of this trial, you saw a lot of, this is one of these jurisdictions where the jury is allowed to ask questions of the witness. And we saw a lot of questions being presented to this trooper regarding about, you know, his observations about what happened during this shooting. And, you know, some may say this is a repugnant verdict. It just doesn't make sense. Who knows if the defense is going to be attacking this. The prosecutions are going to be looking to question this this verdict in that regard. But here, we have a jury which really did a lot of thinking, and they acquitted on the top count. But as the trooper stated in his interview, Trooper Casey, there's going to be a lot of jail time most likely coming to this individual.
And the big question is whether or not the prosecution is going to refile that top charge. That's it for us. Have a good holiday, everybody. We'll see you back here the day after Christmas.